wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with the Center for Biodiversity's Tierra Curry about climate change. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss declining support for capital punishment. And Laurie Mercier speaks with Harvey Schwartz about his new book, Labor Under Siege. First up, can humanity prevent climate roasting? Bill Resnick talks to Tierra Curry, senior scientist and director of the Center for Biodiversity's Saving Life on Earth campaign. Here's Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hello, Tierra Curry. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
Tierra Curry is a senior scientist and Saving Life on Earth campaign director for the Center for Biological Diversity. She's one of those tireless and vastly outnumbered people, still influential, trying to stop the relentless march of those who are plundering the planet for wealth, profit, and a demented sort of status and honor. Those are the people who are generating conditions for the fourth great extinction, including possibility us Homo sapiens. Prior to joining the center in 2007, she worked as an amphibian field biologist, environmental educator, community organizer. Last November, 2 months ago, she was an observer at the United Nations 15th Conference of the Parties on Protecting Biodiversity. She wasn't a delegate because the U.S. Senate refused to ratify the agreement and be part of it, but the United States still has an enormous and unfortunately deleterious influence on the proceedings. The bulk of this interview will cover the great significance of two conferences, the Conference on Biodiversity and the conference just a month ago on climate change. But first, tell us about your own personal journey from where you grew up in the mountains of coal country in eastern Kentucky to become senior scientist and campaign director for the center.
Sure, Bill. Thank you. I grew up in Appalachia in eastern Kentucky, which is an incredibly beautiful and diverse ecosystem of hardwood forest with more salamanders than anywhere else on Earth. So it was beautiful. And the coal companies, unfortunately, have a long history of just ravaging the land there. They tear down the mountains to get the coal and then move on. And so I grew up exploring the natural world and falling in love with frogs and butterflies and birds and even snakes. But then the coal company mined the mountain behind my house and then the mountain in front of my house. And so they ruined our well water. They cracked our windows. So from a very early age, I had this strong sense of injustice in that I needed to change the world and protect biodiversity and help protect the human community from these corporations. So I hardly remember a time when I didn't feel like I needed to take action to protect nature and vulnerable communities. And I was really fortunate to get a job at the Center for Biological Diversity as a conservation biologist because I'm really passionate about extinction. I think it's the ultimate injustice that humans are driving the plants and animals we share the planet with off the planet, especially since we're another species here. So I'm very grateful to be able to fight extinction as my day job and as my passion.
Kara, tell us, before evaluating the two recent conferences, tell us why they are so significant and why the Center for Biological Diversity sent a number of people to both of them.
Right. So the Conference of the Parties on Climate Change and on the Convention on Biological Diversity just happened in the past few months. The Convention on Biological Diversity Conference of the Parties is every decade to work out a global biodiversity framework. So the meetings were supposed to happen in 2020, but because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they got pushed until this year. And the Conference on the Parties on Climate Change meets more often. But these are significant because it's a way when the entire global community comes together to try to figure out how we're going to maintain a livable planet and protect humanity, but also the species we share the planet with, and also address things like poverty and injustice. So they're the biggest questions of our time, and the entire global community meets to try to hash out agreements and as you might imagine, because different stakeholders have very different intents. The meetings are contentious and dramatic, and the agreements that come out of them are often more watered down than activists would like for them to be.
My sense is that most of the world's countries, many very poor, some developing, a few industrialized and rich, but all of them look to those conferences as extremely important places for them to have influence.
For sure. So for the countries that are party to the Convention on Biological Diversity, the framework that comes out of that meeting becomes their national biodiversity strategy. So the goals that are set are what those countries are working towards over the course of the decade. And a lot of countries even have full-time staff that work on them and funding through various international agreements. And for climate change, the thing that comes out of those meetings is really how bad it's going to get here on Earth. And so the agreement to try to keep climate change, to keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, is imperative for us to maintain a livable planet. And to do that, we have to get off of fossil fuels. There's no question we have to move away from fossil fuels. And so this year's climate conference of the parties was very disappointing in that there was no movement to get off of fossil fuels. There was some language adopted to move away from unabated coal, and that means relying on unproven carbon capture and storage technologies. But the big oil producing countries just bullied through no agreement to reduce oil and gas use. The pivotal thing that did come out of it was for the first time countries agreed to a fund to protect countries that are most vulnerable to damage from climate change. But unfortunately, in a parallel with the biodiversity agreement, details were not worked out. And so the big thing that came out of the Convention on Biological Diversity Conference of the Parties was an agreement to protect 30% of all the Earth's land and waters. But there were no details on what would qualify as protected or how that would actually play out, similar to the fund for climate damaged countries. And so these commitments were important, and they're important because it's what the whole world agreed to, but the details haven't been worked out as to how it's actually going to be realized.
This is Bill Resnick here for KBOO Radio, our Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Tierra Curry, grew up in coal country in eastern Kentucky, now a senior scientist and campaign director for the Center for Biological Diversity. So far, we've discussed the significance of UN conferences of the parties to deal with the great international issues like peacekeeping, hunger, poverty and hunger, treatment of the super subordinate like women and racial minorities. We're talking about the Climate Change Conference and the Species Extinction Conference, both of them in the last couple of months. You attended, let's get back to the Conference on Biodiversity, and we're a close observer on climate change. In your discussion, you talked about the one gain in the Biodiversity Conference. It was a promise to protect 30% of the whole planet from human action that would jeopardize their enormous contributions to healthy ecosystems. My sense is that that was part of what I call a greenwashing strategy by the U.S. corporations. Why don't we start with both of these conferences? My reading about them, admittedly mostly from the left, but also the New York Times and other sources, the corporate people have managed to vastly outnumber the environmentalists at these conferences. The biggest delegations are from petrostates like Saudi Arabia and many of the others, Russia. And well, why don't you tell us how they were active at both conferences?
The climate conference, the fossil fuel industry sent so many lobbyists and representatives that, I mean, it could have just been a fossil fuel meeting, except for the environmental justice community who was there, who was very vocal, and who were successful in pushing through the fund to help compensate the countries that are most vulnerable to climate damage. But the solution is going to be to get off of fossil fuels, and progress was not made on that front, largely because of the presence of the fossil fuel lobbyists. And I mean, I like to think that they know that they're a dying industry and that their days are numbered, and that's why they're fighting so hard. But it just means the environmental justice community has even more work to do to help everyone realize that we do have to transition from fossil fuels if we're going to save a livable planet. the Conference of the Parties for the Convention on Biological Diversity didn't have the same presence of lobbyists. But lobbyists, like the United States, is not a party to the convention, and that's largely because of lobbyists from Big Pharma who don't want to compensate countries for their biological resources when corporations profit from them, especially when it comes to genetic resources. And so that tie-up has prevented the United States from becoming a party to the convention, but they were still able to reach an agreement to protect 30% of the Earth. But one of the big things that I was there pushing for was for an agreement to stop extinction. Really, to save a livable planet, we have to save the plants and animals that are parts of the ecosystems that we all depend on. Biodiversity is essential to human health and well-being. It's essential to our economy, and we have to protect it as a top priority. But even at the Convention on Biological Diversity, there was no commitment to stop extinction. And so that was very disappointing. There was a commitment to reduce extinction rate and risk and some commitment to restore ecosystems, but it definitely wasn't enough. So in that sense, both of these conferences didn't accomplish what they really needed to accomplish, which was to get away from fossil fuels and to commit to ending human-caused extinction.
Yeah. You know what we should explain, I think, something that I had not appreciated, actually, how stopping extinctions, not just of tigers and polar bears that get a lot of attention, but in fact, insects and microbes are essential to maintaining especially soil diversity, but also just the greenhouse gases and their fixation. If we destroy our soils, we are in fact committing suicide, and we're really on the path of that. Tell us about it.
Bill, you're absolutely correct. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, has given several prominent speeches now saying that humanity must end our suicidal war against nature. And that's because our entire existence is propped up by the water cycle, by forests that produce oxygen, by wetlands that store carbon and filter water, and by pollinators and ecosystems that provide us with food. And so we like to think that we're separate from nature, but actually we're entirely dependent on it, and we've always taken it for granted, and we have to turn around and take care of it. And so a lot of people who oppose endangered species like to point out any individual species like the snail darter and say that it's blocking progress and hurting the economy. But the reality is that our destiny is tied to the well-being of all of the plants and animals we share the planet with, from snails to freshwater mussels to bees to monarch butterflies, the species that are beautiful and the species that aren't so beautiful. We really need to protect all of them to secure our own well-being. And also, I think we need to protect them because it's the right thing to do, because they have as much of a right to be here as we do. And so really, it comes down to values. And I think that getting people to move towards protecting things comes down to getting them to see and appreciate them, and also to understand the connections between everything.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Tierra Curry, who grew up in the coal fields of Eastern Kentucky. She's now a senior scientist and campaign director for the Center for Biological Diversity. So far, we've discussed the significance of the UN conferences of the parties to deal with all sorts of profound international issues, peacekeeping, poverty, and hunger. Also, the super subordinate treatment of the super subordinate, like women and racial minorities. We just discussed the two conferences in the last 2 months, its importance to prevent extinction, and also the relation of biodiversity to climate change and extinction. Let's go a little bit further into the climate change conference. It did promise to compensate poor countries for loss, that is, for the great losses they are incurring because of climate change. But my sense is those promises are really easy to make and even easier to ignore. For example, in 2009, they pledged $100 billion to compensate those countries and help them adapt. Well, it's been ignored by most major powers, and the U.S. continuously reiterates demands that all major polluters, including China and India, contribute to the fund. Well, China and India say, you caused it, we didn't, even though they're now the world's greatest polluters, but still a minority of the greenhouse gas concentration. And they say, we're poor, you're rich, you have to give much more than us. And the U.S. has decided, in their wisdom, to ignore them. In any event, it seems to me that that promise to reimburse the countries for loss and damage, it's sort of, again, it's greenwashing. The countries and the people who run them, the elites who run them, can easily make those promises and don't keep them. And there's nobody enforcing them. How do you respond to that issue?
I mean, in some ways, the entire compensation fund without a commitment to get off fossil fuels is greenwashing. It rings hollow because the more fossil fuels we burn, the greater the damage is going to be, the more funding there's going to need to be for mitigation. And ultimately, we won't be able to repair everything if we don't address the problem. It's like trying to treat lung cancer without stopping smoking. We have to move away from fossil fuels and not just commit to try to repair or mitigate the damage. The issue of what countries are going to pay and what countries are going to benefit was the most contentious issue at the biodiversity conference and the climate conference. At the biodiversity conference, countries from the global south walked out at one point because the global north wasn't committing to help protect biodiversity, because rich countries like the United States and Europe, we export our extinction footprint by importing resources from other countries, and then the people who live there don't even necessarily benefit from those. And it's the same thing with the fossil fuel countries. The countries that use the most fossil fuel aren't the countries that pay the steepest price in terms of public health and climate disasters. And so really, we have to address the core of the issue, which is overconsumption by wealthy nations of fossil fuels and other products. And we need to commit to helping the most vulnerable countries. But it all comes back to values. What are we going to value? What are we going to protect? Are we willing to use less stuff to have a livable planet? And so these are big, wicked problems. But the good thing is that more and more people are becoming aware of them and are committed to learning what they can do and taking action to help fight injustice in humanity and in the biological community.
You ended your statements, it seemed to me, on a note of optimism. Optimism of not just the will, but there's good reason for optimism of the intellect. Give us your sense of the, what are the major developments that we can look to that could, in fact, manage to defeat the interests who are now ransacking the planet?
You know, as the Saving Life on Earth campaign director, part of my job is outreach. And so I talk to students all the time, from kindergarteners all the way through grad students. And the thing that gives me hope is that this generation coming up has so much awareness and so much passion. Like, I talk to kids in grade school who are doing projects to fight climate change. And a decade ago, we wouldn't even have total agreement that it's happening. But now there are young people who are passionate to do something about it. I just spoke with a college student in the Midwest who's doing a project of her own accord on pollinators. She's passionate about talking to people about the pollinator crisis. And so interacting with these young individuals who are educated and inspired and also taking action gives me hope. When I have despair, I just remember that action is the antidote to despair. And so if we all do work together, we can keep a livable planet.
Yeah. May I add just one point? Another reason for optimism is that we have the forces to protect diversity and manage climate change and maintain it within manageable levels and then bring the concentrations down. Has sufficient technologies and resources to deal with those problems and restore to health the ecosystem upon which life depends, human life included. Tara Curry, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thanks so much, Bill. I'm so happy to talk about these things. Thank you for helping raise awareness of them.
the Lionel Hampton Quartet here on the Old Mall Variety Hour. On the sunny side of the street followed Bill Resnick talking with Tierra Curry. Up next in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker look at declining support for capital punishment and what this portends for life without the possibility of parole. Here's Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mall Variety Hour.
Well, good morning, Mike, and Happy New Year.
Same to you, Jan.
Or perhaps we should say hopeful New Year. Your work as an appellate lawyer for people on death row takes you into some of the cruelest practices of the state. But you also see hopeful signs of progress. Support for the death penalty continued its long-term decline in the U.S. in 2022. At the close of the year, Oregon commuted its death row and new death sentences, and public support for the death penalty remained near 50-year lows. So let's talk about key issues in public support for or opposition to capital punishment, starting with Kate Brown's decision at the end of her term as governor. What was that decision and what do you make of it in the shift from an ongoing moratorium of the death penalty?
Well, it was very bold and clear. You know, Oregon had done some clever legislating 2 years ago to basically remove the death penalty implicitly from everyone. But she came out and said that, unlike previous commutations, she's not doing anything based on rehabilitative efforts. She said, instead, it reflects the recognition that the death penalty is immoral. It's an irreversible punishment that does not allow for correction. It's wasteful. It does not make communities safer. It cannot be and never has been administered fairly and equitably. And her announcement made quite a splash all over the country. It was featured in the every annual review of the death penalty, and is actually a template that California is following. And California has about a third of everybody in this country.
And that's where most of your work is in California, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I had two Oregon cases that have gone now, and there's 690 people on death row in California.
And that's a sizable percentage of the overall people on death row in this country, correct?
Yeah, there's about 2,500 total around the country. So it's a big chunk. And they are doing what Oregon did. In Oregon in 2019 just systematically deconstructed death row. They sent everybody away to other prisons and mixed them in with other prisoners. They got rid of the execution gear and room. And California is doing exactly the same thing. This year in particular, they started voluntarily transferring people to other parts of the state. This year, they're taking down all of death row, and they're going to move everybody out of San Quentin and distribute them up and down the state, mostly to prisons in the California Central Valley or in the southern part of the state.
What's the significance of that integrating of death row inmates with other prisoners in terms of their experience of that and the kind of the sociology of life in prisons?
Well, it shows in practice that people on death row are widely varied. Some of them have never did anything bad before or since. Others have been always bad, but have learned how to adapt. People on death row, the experience thus far has been that they are just like every other prisoner. They don't in any way stand out with their behavior.
It just from kind a management point of view, these are not, you know, troublemakers or hard to manage people in prison.
That's right. So the most remarkable thing to me about 2022 is that there was such a deluge of crime and punishment rhetoric. The Republicans made it the basis of their effort to reclaim political power in places where the Democrats had been ruling. And they just saturated the media. But it was all about how much they love cops. It was all about trying to create climates of fear that completely left out the death penalty. So a survey, the survey you mentioned, it was a Gallup poll taken at the height of the political campaign during the trial, the Parkland killer, and it showed the same long-term decline in belief in the death penalty that has been in effect for over 20 years now. So what was the chief issue in like the 1988 election? Michael Dukakis probably lost to George Bush because of the death penalty. Bill Clinton visited an execution to begin his campaign for the presidency. it was the ticket to power for prosecutors and for legislators who wanted to rise in the world. But now it's a dispirited world on the state's side. Everybody there knows that the death penalty is not a matter of great interest or concern. It's completely lost the steam that it used to have.
And even in the far right.
Yeah, they're all about kissing the police and funding the police and toxic homeless people. They've got lots of things to say about crime and punishment, but none of them include the death penalty.
So, I mean, this is also an activity of the state that is perhaps different from cops policing on the street, those aspects of the state. Is there something symptomatic about the administration and the long process it takes that's involved in killing someone that doesn't fit with kind of that swift justice, the rowdy side of the far right that is more interested in dismantling the state than having it execute its cruelties more efficiently?
Well, two or three things have happened. I think one is the DNA has shown that the state gets it wrong. And somehow the right wing has always had this mysterious exception. They attack government in every way, but they've never questioned the efforts of the police to identify killers and then to execute them. But it's now obvious that mistakes not only have been made, but are being made. And even I, a professional skeptic, have been shocked at how many bad cases there are. It's just the police get these confirmatory hypotheses. They get an idea really quickly. They see nothing that would cause them to question what their first guess was, and they get it wrong all the time. And the narratives on television and the movies have repeatedly portrayed that story, and it's gripping. I mean, the idea of an innocent person being executed is a chilling one, I think, for everybody. So, and that has had an effect. It's made a lot of right-wingers know that this is government work like all other government work. It's full of mistakes, and the consequences are irreversible, as Kate Brown said.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, for one thing, it's different from other kinds of government work. It's ethically prohibited for doctors, and I believe most health professionals, to administer the death penalty. So many of the prison officials who carry out these executions have not been trained in even basic emergency work and putting in an IV and using these drugs. So it's in his own category. And I wonder about the botched executions thesis. It's kind of like abortion. For a long time, abortion rights rode on botched abortions, but those had signal value over a period of time. But I don't think the botched abortions accounted for the shifts over time in abortion politics in this country. I mean, there is a kind of high moral ground that has been claimed by conservatives, including conservative Catholics. But I think some of the news around how the European Union would not allow drugs to come into this country to be used to kill people because it's considered immoral and illegal in much of the world. I think for many people, that was news, that this is considered basically an expression of cruelty and unjust in how it's carried out.
Well, it is pretty creepy. I mean, because it is so hard to get execution drugs, you've got these stories of Arizona officials meeting behind shuttered malls, buying plain brown wrappers with cash money. I mean, it's the whole process of obtaining the drugs is very shady.
It took them into that, away from the clinical field and into the shady world of drug dealers.
Exactly. That's where they are.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to do it. Now, I'm not medically hip enough to know what their problems are, but I know they spend hours and hours poking veins in some people and are still unable to somehow kill them with these.
Well, so what's considered an effective execution historically in terms of the displays of cruelty or suffering and the role of suffering in these cases? Anesthesiologist from Emory University said lethal injection creates a circus of suffering. What does that mean?
Because you have three drugs, basically. The typical combination or cocktail involves a drug that will paralyze you and one that keeps you from like expressing concern or expressing any feelings, even of extreme pain, and another one that kills you that's extremely painful.
That stops your heart.
Yeah. It's basically the drawings are that you are completely paralyzed, you can't express anything, and you're suffering, you're being subjected to this immense pain.
So a botched execution, and this is a term that has gathered a lot of currency, botched execution is one where you see the struggle involved and you are witness to the pain.
Well, that's one kind. Another kind is where you're simply unable to pull it off. There have been three instances recently where they've not been able to actually execute somebody. They've not been able to find the right vein, the right place to inject the poison. So in Tennessee and Alabama have now stopped or suspended all executions because of instances where they tried but failed to execute someone. So they're reviewing their whole procedure. Yeah, 2022 was notable not only for the continuation, despite all the political rhetoric, of the decline in support of the death penalty. It's also noticeable for the repeated instances of failures at attempting to execute by way of lethal injection.
So what do you see ahead if this trajectory continues and state by state, the death chambers are closed and sentencing is taken off the options and there is both life without possibility of parole, which is another cruel sentence of the state. And also this becomes like making abortions illegal, kind of a signature policy of right-wing states. Is that what we're seeing ahead?
Well, for one, it's going to be very fragmented because the U.S. Supreme Court now is leading the way to executions. They do everything they possibly can to further executions. They don't even bother to write opinions anymore. They just grease the skids. So it will be a state-by-state matter. And right now, executions are concentrated in a handful of states. Texas and Oklahoma together have more than half of all executions last year. That will continue. So I think we'll see the red and blue states split. But now it's 37 states. That's more than three quarters of the states in this country have gotten rid of the death penalty. So it will live on in the places where it lives on right now. But it will live on problematically, and there will be difficulties. And I don't know. You know, this country has long waves of gradually increasing support and gradually decreasing support in the death penalty. And there's a long wave in effect now. It was not altered this year, despite the intense political rhetoric. So I think it's going to stay in place, and I think the death penalty will continue to fade here and fade there for the foreseeable
future. Well, before we close, let's talk about life without possibility of parole. I remember in earlier Left in the Law segments, you said that as long as the death penalty is in practice, it sucks all the political oxygen out of the room in addressing life without possibility of parole. What's your assessment of that now?
Just the same. I mean, there are a lot of things to say about life without possibility of parole, or LWOP, as it's known in the legal community. It creates a situation where you've got nothing to lose, and that's always risky for an administrator. So I think that the exploration of what that truly means is going to be something that we can't get to until the death penalty is resolved. But what's happening now is that as courts get worse and worse, legislators and prosecutors get better and better. And legislation in California now has passed that allows people who are under the age of 25, it effectively refuses LWOP. It says you must make such people eligible for parole because they weren't the new mental science that's guiding the legislature is that you're not a fully formed person until age 25.
And so, that age has been consistently pushed up historically for reasons that may have more to do with politics and science, but it's still a good trend.
So what's happening is you can be the minimum age for being executed is 18. That happened about 20 years ago. Before that, you could be executed at age 13 or 14. But now,
you mean in any state?
Yes, in any state. The U.S. Supreme Court said that the Eighth Amendment prohibits execution of people under the age of 18.
Yeah.
So that's a universal law now in this country.
But states, like with abortion, can introduce their own criteria.
That's right. So what California has done, they passed a law now saying you've got to give people a chance for parole because they will change. They have changed. We know that after the age of 25. So there's a paradox now, in effect, is that you can be executed if you are 22 when you committed your crime, but you cannot be denied a chance at parole.
Yeah, so maybe there is something about highlighting these cases and the irrationalities of the state, as well as its cruelties and the racism and class and arbitrary basis of some of these sentences. You said you can have very, very different outcomes whether the crime is committed in one part of the country or another.
Absolutely. And there is a serious effort being made right now in California with the passage of a Racial Justice Act to examine ways in which racism affects every part of the prosecution, beginning with the police who are investigating the case and gathering evidence through the choice of prosecution to make whatever sentence, to the selection of a jury, through the whole process. And I think there's no doubt now that racism has infected every part of this process. We're finding just an oral argument, the way the whole concept of gangs, you know, white people belong to hate groups, but black people and brown people belong to, quote, gangs. And there's this demonization of groups of adolescents gathering together.
Including in how in prisons, right, the sociology of prisons themselves and how particular prisoners are identified.
Sure. Well, I think what's happening is that the sentence of LWOP is at play, and it's going to be, we're going to be talking about it a lot more. It's going to be eroded by recognitions, for example, that people change over, and particularly people whose crimes are committed as late as teenagers or very young adults, are not going to be the same people. I mean, I've seen that transition because the super due process means I've got cases that I've been appointed 35 years ago on. People are simply in no way the same beings that they once were. They don't have the same vocabulary, the same morality, the same way of approaching the world, the same way of weighing things. They have changed. And that's a fact. That happens. So what are we going to do? What impact does that fact have? Does it mean nothing in light of the magnitude of the crime, or does it mean a lot?
Yeah. Well, there's, I think you're saying the subtext here is there's reasons for hope on the political horizon, and we need to keep pushing further and deeper into the support and opposition to capital punishment and put it in a larger context than often even the news does in covering botched abortions. There's a lot more to be said here. And you're saying reason for hope as we look ahead.
Absolutely. In places where there was no hope 30 years ago, like district attorney offices, legislatures, and the places where we used to place all of our hopes, namely the courts, are the worst place in the world to be right now.
Well, thanks, Mike, for this new year in review for the death penalty and your take on where we're at. Have a good new year, and we'll see you next month.
You got it, Jen. See you then.
Thank you.
an instrumental version of Something by the Beatles that followed Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, Laurie Mercier speaking with author Harvey Schwartz about his new book, Labor Under Siege, an Oral History of Big Bob McElrath and the ILWU's Fight for Organized Labor in an Anti-Union Era. Here's Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm speaking today with Harvey Schwartz, author of a new book about the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Labor Under Siege, an Oral History of Big Bob McElrath and the ILWU's Fight for Organized Labor in an Anti-Union Era. Welcome back to KABU, Harvey.
Hey, hello, Laurie, and thank you for inviting me.
Let me give you a brief introduction, and then we can talk about some of the book's lessons for the labor movement today. Harvey Schwartz is curator of the Oral History Collection at the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, or ILWU, Library in San Francisco. He's the author of a number of books about working people, including Building the Golden Gate Bridge, A Worker's Oral History, Solidarity Stories, an Oral History of the ILWU, and The March Inland, Origins of the ILWU Warehouse Division. Harvey, you really are an authority on the ILWU, a union that has an important and militant history in the Portland-Vancouver area, not only on the docks, but also at Powell's Books. Why did you write this book about Bob McElrath?
Well, it's a central part of the union's history that's not been written about very much. That is to say, the period from around 1980 to the very recent past, approximately 2018, when Bob retired. He retired at the end of that year. And we had determined, that is, I had and other people, really, and many other people besides me, had determined we should do an oral history with Big Bob before he retires from office. And so I said, sounds like a wonderful idea, and we went forward from there.
And as the book's title, Labor Under Siege, suggests, this is more than a story of one leader. It details some of the rockiest times for American labor in the late 20th century, when unions were losing members and contract battles and the number of strikes, which are labor's most potent weapon, dramatically declined. What were some of these multi-pronged attacks on the ILWU and other unions at this time?
Well, I think it's interesting when you look at it. If you go back in time a little bit, there was kind of a new look on the waterfront in 1948 when the employers decided no more red baiting. They'd get along with Harry Bridges, the original president. And there was kind of an era good feeling, and there was even a cooperative effort in 1960 for the unions to accept mechanization. That is really, at that time, containerization. The employers come around the period 1980-81 when Ronald Reagan became the president of the United States, and he basically broke the air controller strike in 1981. And after that, employers became pretty militant in their anti-union stance, including the employers of the longshore workers on the West Coast. And they moved to a position of really opposing bargaining in good faith and negotiations, dragging their heels on a negotiation, trying to undermine contract specifications, which were agreed to, really opposing union comfort in every direction, making the union look bad in particularly, for example, in 2014, the employer cut manning, and it is number of people on the job, and then charged the union with slowing down, when actually they've been the ones who cut down the number of people on the job. They've used labor law against the Longshore Union, against all American unions, really. The secondary boycott was made illegal under Taft-Hartley, a new law in 1947, or a new, really, an amendment to the old National Labor Relations Act. The employers have pushed automation in many ways, even when automation might not be that efficient, but they want to get rid of the workers, get rid of the people. All you have to do is deal with machines. And they fought organizing that the Longshore Union and other unions really looked at with captive audiences, you know, who get given the Riot Act, really, unionism is bad for you, etc., selected firing and so on and so on. So you get the picture. It's really been an era since about 1980, which was coincidentally when Big Bob first got active in the union. It's been an anti-union era. It's really not over now, notwithstanding new stirrings.
So, Harvey, even though Taft-Hartley's passed in 1947, which really restricts American labor did have some degree of power through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and then begins to lose some of its power as it loses members, partly due to mechanization and global competition. But in terms of that mechanization, longshore workers saw their numbers decline by half as a result of that container revolution of the 60s and 70s. And did those pressures from employers to mechanize continue after that?
Oh, yeah. They've continued right to down to the present. There was a big push in Los Angeles to a robotic system in place in one of the big container terminals down there. They've continued to push it. There's no question of that. And what the union has done in response, at least our union and I think other unions, they have tried to say, okay, if you're going to push the machine in, and by the way, there was a plank in an old, actually going back to 1934, a piece of actually the first contract that said labor-saving devices can be moved in. Nobody in 1934 realized how important that was going to be. But there has been an effort by the unions to say, okay, you're going to move this machine in, but whatever jurisdiction remains is going to be ours. That is to say, machine may replace workers, but there are going to be still some people to press the buttons or whatever, and they have to be ILW, and we insist on that. And anything that's left over, that is any other jobs left over, should also be our jobs within our jurisdiction. And, of course, the union has complained all along, and I think with good reason, that the employers will try to bite around the edges and to limit their work and to take it away and to undermine their position of holding on to their jurisdiction. So that's the union response. But this battle has been ongoing and is still ongoing. I mean, in many ways, the machine is labor-saving, but it's also the enemy of workers. It takes away their jobs, takes the sandwich out of their lunchbox.
And as one union member said, I think in your book, that it's one thing to have power when you have 6,000 other workers behind you, but when there are only 1,000, you know, you have less clout. And
yes,
so mechanization has really reduced that clout just by reducing sheer numbers of workers who can stand together. But speaking of standing together, the ILWU is famous for supporting labor and social justice causes across the West Coast and Pacific, across the globe, actually. How did this union move beyond simple bread and butter unionism, that is just negotiating wage and benefit gains for its own members, to be so active in collectively voicing opposition to unjust actions around the world, such as the war in Iraq?
Yeah, the ILWU has been this way since its beginning in 1933, 1934. Of course, the Great Strike was 1934. And to some degree, I think it's because of Harry Bridges, the original leader, and the people around him. They were what we would call progressives or liberals today. And Bridges, for example, invited black workers in. Other people were involved with him in the union in 1934. And they realized, I mean, there's a practical end to that at that time, that you can keep people from being strike breakers if you invite them in, if you're all-inclusive. Be that as it may, there is this humane streak. And I think it goes back to Harry. And I think, in some sense, Harry's thumb is still on the union, even all these years after his death in 1990. And all the people, I don't know if not everybody, but the great bulk of the people and the officers and so forth, stick with that tradition. And it's still there. And it has served them well.
And they uphold the motto, an injury to one is an injury to all, which really dates back to the Knights of Labor and the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, recognizing this kind of worker struggle across the world.
Oh, absolutely. And I think they still adhere to it. You know, as I say, I think Harry's thumb is still on the union. And there have been so many good leaders, you know, following him, right down to Willie Adams, who's president right now of the International. And they've just stuck with that humane perspective. In the book I did, there's a section in the latter part of the book about aiding Native Americans in their struggle against a pipeline in the Dakotas and things like that. And the union has stood for accepting black workers and supporting black rights all the way through from 1934 onward.
The book focuses on the leadership of McElrath, who had to steer the ILWU through multiple challenges. And the book raises some interesting questions about the role of compromise and how to survive in an anti-union era. So, I mean, what did you learn from all these interviews you conducted with members about how far unions can go in making demands or in committing to actions when labor law, such as it is in the United States, is so against you?
You have to be militant the way the union has been. You have to try. You go out and organize. All the organizing drives they tried were not successful somewhere, but you have to keep after it. And yet you have to be prudent in one sense to know that if you go too far, you're going to get in trouble and you're going to get hit with Taft-Hartley charges. For example, the union was sued a few years ago under secondary boycott part of the Taft-Hartley Act. So you've got to go for it, but you've got to also realize, you know, that there are times when you might have to back off. The union was very militant in the so-called EGT strike, which that's really a group called the Export Grain Terminal, around the year 2011. And they fought tooth and nail. They really did. In the end, when the Coast Guard was coming up the river to open fire on the workers if they blocked a delivery at one terminal, and they had let it be known they were going to open fire, and they were going to, you know, they were going to kill workers, and the workers were going to stand against that. They were going to stand up to it. Miguel Ruff realized, you know, well, we have to go for a deal at this point. I don't want to get all our guys killed. And the governor of the state of Washington at that time came up with a program in which the deal was cut. Union didn't come out in a perfect shape. It came out, you know, it got jurisdiction in that plant, which is what they were after to begin with. So you have to be careful. You got to be prudent, you know.
And that was a struggle up in Longview, right?
Well, that's right.
Local 40.
Well, that was actually Local 21 in Longview. Mm-hmm. Local 40 is the ship clerks group in Portland. And I'm sure they were there because everybody went up there to help from the different locals.
Yeah. Well, that, I think, can help the labor movement today as it is reasserting itself. What other lessons can the labor movement learn from ILWU strategies, advances and mistakes during this anti-union period of the late 20th, early 21st centuries?
Well, as I was noting, one thing, you got to pick your battles, and you got to be careful about it. You have to be prudent when it's important to be prudent, but you have to fight for survival and for expansion and organizing when you can. Sometimes you have to accept compromises and treats, but you have to be smart about it. And I think that can benefit people, that is to say, what's in the book can benefit people who look at this, at their experiences moving forward. The other thing about that, which I think is important, is people can look at this experience of this union and say, notwithstanding it was a tough time, those guys survived and those women survived with a democratic, worker-driven, honest, progressive organization. For example, in the book, there's some discussion of the longshore caucuses, which would meet before negotiations would occur. And at that time, everybody would come from as representatives from different ports and different locals, and they would discuss, you know, what we want from our port and, you know, what this other group of folks might want. And they would come to a consensus as to what the negotiations were going to include. That is to say, what we're going to ask for. And it seems to me that that might be helpful for people to look at that and see how, from the inside, you know, democratic decisions were come to and that benefit and help the union move forward. And in addition to that, if you look at this book, you know, you've got a social justice union, and still in all, you can fight to keep that tradition and, you know, maintain a democratic, clean, rank-and-file organization and still battle for the party of humanity. So I think there are a lot of lessons that can be taken in this regard, you know, from looking at the ILWU's experience.
And inspiring all of us for a new movement that will unite workers of the world. Thanks so much, Harvey Schwartz, for joining us on the Old Mole Variety Hour and for telling us about your new book, Labor Under Siege, available at Powell's Books. And if you order from Powell's through the Local 5 website, the local receives over 7% of the sale for its strike fund. And we'll provide a link to it. Heyboo.fm. So long, Harvey.
Thank you again. Thank you so much, Lori.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for January 9, 2023. I'm John Nelson. Thanks to Lori Mercier and Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Harvey Schwartz and Tierra Curry. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.